Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Fat Nick Osello.
Nick, what is that? Hey.
You have a burner.
Hey, whoa. Yeah, I finally made it a burner. Fat Nick Osello, who posted. So I took a peek at it. And if you hear background noise, I'm in the office. The grind never stops. So deal with it. Grow up. And yeah, he made that clown edit of me in the Delaware and literally posted that to about, I don't know, 20 or 30 different random lacrosse tweets. So I think I made it. Is that a sign that you made it, Terry?
Congratulations. You are officially a big deal. You're at Ty Zander's level now. Mm.
Don't compare me to him.
It is Final Four week, which means that we have the quarterfinals in the rear view. And I mean, I got to be honest, we're going to fly through these games because there wasn't as much drama as we could have hoped for. Certainly the closest margin of victory being two goals was a departure from the preceding 2 years that we had quarterfinals in which six of those games went to overtime. And Nick, we're going to start with the most recent game as we did last week. And unfortunately, it wasn't a huge momentous upset. Instead, it was once again the Maryland Terrapins asserting their dominance with an 18-9 victory over Virginia. I mean,
yeah.
That's basically all you can say. This team is on a track to being historically dominant, and whether it's the offensive end of the field, the defensive end of the field, or Luke Weirman facing off, you can start anywhere. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that they had, I believe, 14 players register a point. Anthony DeMeo and Logan Wisnowskis both had 3 goals and 2 assists. Anthony DeMeo, the public now knows more widely than they previously did, that he's the lone remaining member of the 2017 National Championship team, and we've talked about him on this podcast previously as a San Diego guy. And Wisnowskis, if he didn't seal his Torton Award, I'd be shocked. The only way in which I could see him losing it at this point is if Maryland loses in the semifinals to Princeton and he gets blanked. In that scenario, I suppose it's possible that they could give it to Chris Gray as kind of a career achievement, all-time leading scorer type honor. But aside from that, Maryland is the best team in the country. Lars Tiffany said post-game that they're the best team in 16 years since the 2006 Virginia Cavaliers. And Logan Wisnowskis is apparently the best player on the best team. It was just a remarkable kind of mechanical disassembly of the Virginia Cavaliers.
Yeah, I mean, that was the only word that I could use is dismantle. I think the real bummer and the real crime here is that we'll never know if Maryland is the best team because the best teams didn't make the playoffs this year. So that's my spin zone that I'm going with, is this is going to be an asterisk year for them because Notre Dame's not in the playoffs. Other than that, the only thing that I was truly shocked by, you know, I expected Maryland to win. I didn't expect them to blow the doors off of the thing. But in watching that game, the only thing that makes it fun is like, oh, if I'm like pretending to be on the Princeton coaching staff and going like, okay, what could we do to beat this team? And the scariest part about this team, I think, is how significant of a bump they made in the transition game, making Virginia, a very athletic and very smart team, look like, you know, a sixth grade team that was just figuring out how to substitute through the midfield and falling for all the bait and falling for everything. And I don't know, you know, how it almost is like Maryland has been so good and they know that they're going to win in settled sixes and man up, man down and face offs and everything. They can be like dedicating a decent amount of practice time to like playing games in substitution. It's the only explanation I have for it, is that they have literally peaked and they're like, we don't need to work on offense or defense. What should we do? Tillman kind of sitting around going, what else could we get good at? And he decided, hey, let's just kill Virginia in the substitution game for fun as a prank. And I don't know, Terry, again, you said it like 4 weeks ago. Like, I don't know how else to describe what's going on or, you know, what else even to say about this Maryland team. And I think in the last 4 weeks, it's only gotten to a point where it's everyone in the country is agreeing with you. What do you say? What do you say?
So I think you hit on one of the two, or actually three, most interesting things to come away from this game. There were a couple of instances in the first quarter and a half where they won these substitution games, and you know, it was Virginia's playing poorly. Like, why is this happening? But then once it happened, when Roman Pugliese did it, and I'm not sure whether it was late in the third or early in the fourth, and Roman Pugliese, by the way, is like, to me, the prototypical guy of the last 5 years who didn't want to be a D-middie, like thought he was good enough and probably was at 92% of the programs in Division I good enough to play offense, but did it willingly and emerged as, I think he's pretty clearly the best short stick D-middie in the country this year. So when he, and I don't remember who was the middie who was trying to, the Virginia middie who was trying to sub off with him was, but he, you know, did the very normal jog halfway back to the midline, then turn around and sprint back. So meaning that he had like already fallen behind the Virginia midfielder who was closer to the midline. So that guy basically had to choose, am I going to go all the way to the midline and unlock the defensive middie coming over? Or am I going to try to like get back and disrupt this? And he chose to release Grayson Soliday to come down and play defense. But meanwhile, Pugliese just stepped into an completely open, you know, 13-yard step down, high to low. And at that point, Matt Nunes hadn't had the same type of day that he was having against Brown, and he just canned it. And it was very much a whipped cream on top of a Sunday type of moment, but very, to your point, emblematic. And I think that whether it was, you know, flubbing a couple first-time ground balls, which I think we saw a ton, and to me was just a reminder of the fact that the quarterfinals are the hardest game because you don't get the juice from the NFL stadium crowd. You have so much built up nervous energy because if you lose, you don't get that, right? You don't get to play on that stage. You don't get the extra four practices of, you know, the best, most fun practices that you have the entire year. So just the, I remember it was Brett Queener who really opened my eyes to this. You know, he obviously is known for a lot of different aspects of his on-field performance and his personality, but he's a historian of the game and somebody who cherishes the history of college lacrosse. And so, you know, one of the most memorable things from his career at Albany was after they lost in overtime to Cornell in the quarterfinals and he missed out on his opportunity to go to the Final Four, he broke his stick over his leg. And I remember having that conversation with him years later and how pure that emotion was because that was how disappointing it is. And I think he was a senior at the time, so he knew it was his last opportunity to do that. And, you know, I think when you take that type of disappointment and convert it into the nervous energy that you see at the start of the game, a lot of times it manifests in missing first-time ground balls and, you know, just overthrow, like skying passes, which we saw Yale do a ton. And for Virginia, you know, how meaningful must it have been to have their best player attackman, who probably isn't the guy that you expect to be laying the wood, to absolutely lay out Scott Bauer 7 seconds into the game, just from a tone setting standpoint. Like, I mean, again, when we're talking about symbols or emblems of the game, you know, that Pugliese goal for me was one that illustrated Virginia getting outfoxed at the thing that so many people expect them to be the best at, but also just from the standpoint of Maryland showing we're not here to mess around. We're here to win the game and the fight. Like, it was pretty impressive, and you know, they definitely laid it down.
Yeah, you know, over before it started kind of is how I felt. And I was like, you know, Virginia needs to get 2 goals off the faceoff, you know, kind of set the tone that like, oh, we're not afraid, you know. And I don't want to say David versus Goliath, but I feel like, you know, this Maryland team has made every game that they play that in a sense. So, you know, not to discredit Virginia in that analogy, but, you know, you need to come out and throw an absolute haymaker to start. And the fact that they got punched in the mouth, you know, with less than 10 seconds, you know, off the clock in the start of the game, I was like, this is over. This game's over. Like, Maryland coming out and throwing a haymaker right off the bat, it was like, this is as bully ball as it gets. And also, I think something worth noting again, just like the thing that always surprises me, contrasting it with some other teams that I was watching this weekend, is Maryland's proclivity to pass up a good opportunity, knowing that they'll get a great opportunity. that is what this team does better than any other team in the history of college lacrosse. And the only comparison I can make is to some PLL teams that have, you know, the depth across the roster that have six really good threats, because there were shots that I was like, what the hell? Like, why didn't you take that, only for, you know, 10 seconds later, them to get a complete layup, even better shot. Like, I don't know how Tillman has done it. I don't know how you coach college kids to not take good shots, knowing that they probably could score those, to pass it up to get great shots. And that's what this team, I think, is unequivocally number one best in the history of college lacrosse at.
I want to call out the other end of the field, because I don't know. I guess this doesn't really come as a huge surprise. They had Brett Makar guard Matt Moore, and I think that, you know, that is kind of like a body style choice, right? Like, taller, thicker matchup makes sense. And then more of a speed matchup with Ajax Zapatello guarding Connor Schellenberger. For me, Schellenberger was the only guy who was in a position to challenge Wisnoskis for the Twarden, and Connor Schellenberger put up 0 points. And Ajax Zapatello is absolutely the primary reason that that is the case. And on a weekend in which so much was talked about with respect to great players coming out of Portland, and it was definitely a big topic of conversation in the Penn-Rutgers game, because Ross Scott is from there, as is Sam Hanley. And then there were other guys throughout the weekend. Ajax Zapatello is arguably the best at them. I mean, and, you know, I tweeted this after the game, but Dan Kaplan covered the Maryland-Boston University scrimmage for us at the beginning of the season. It was Maryland's first scrimmage, if memory serves. And, you know, he was giving us, like, live updates, and he told us that Zapatello was starting. And I was like, oh, that's great. I mean, you know, this is a sophomore, a player who, you know, everybody on our staff has really thought highly of, you know, kind of projected as like a second, third LSM. So the fact that he had made the transition to playing close D, and then the fact that he was in the mix to start. Now, Owen Probilski, who had transferred in from Villanova, was out due to injury. So I think we kind of quickly came to the assumption that that's great. He's probably solidified himself as the fourth guy. And when Probilski comes back, he's going to get bumped down into maybe a man down role. And, you know, if somebody gets hurt over the course of the year, he's going to get his opportunity or whatever. And, you know, a couple games in, particularly when he guarded Tucker Dordovic, another Oregon guy, in that high-profile game against Syracuse, it was like, oh, okay, he is, like, solidly a starter. Probilski is back in the lineup, and Zapatello is whatever. He went on to have a third-team All-American season, and then, you know, that was only 2 weeks ago that that media vote happened. If we were to retake it now, I don't know how high he would end up going, because, I mean, the performance that he put in on Sunday afternoon, limiting Connor Schellenberger in the way that he did, was really something special, something to behold. And, you know, him and Luke Weirman, who we talked about this, I believe, on last week's podcast, just in terms of the development and the improvement from 1 year to the next, like, you know, Zapatello, for my memory, like, barely got on the field last year. To go from that to this is not something that you can reasonably expect. You can reasonably expect him to emerge maybe even as a starter, but this was like a star type role. It was really incredible.
Next game, I'm done talking about Maryland.
I've got one more thing, and this can transition into a little bit of like previewing next week. But I really wanted to see Virginia press out and chase Maryland all over the field. You know, I think I was sitting with Brian Holman, the former Utah coach, at the MIAA championship game on Friday night, and our conversation veered to this game. And, you know, his comment was, you got to figure out a way to take them out of their rhythm. They're just such a rhythm-oriented offense. And for me, we saw Virginia play zone, and that's one way to try to take them out of the rhythm. I think the conventional wisdom is that, you know, really proficient passing teams and good mid-range to long-range shooting teams pick apart zones, right? That's what zones don't do. They make you passive, so they don't make you stretch out to shooters and disrupt them when they're at range. You know, it kind of is meant to cut off the middle of the field. And so, you know, I want to see a defense that says, we're just going to try to terrorize these guys because they're not that fast. And maybe they are that fast, but I think that's the one aspect of this that hasn't been proven, right? The ball moves so fast that we don't know how fast the feet move on these, you know, top six, top nine Maryland offensive players. And, you know, Cole Kastner and Case Sostad, you would imagine, have the physicality to stretch out and do that. They didn't really try. And I think Princeton might as well. I was really impressed by Pace Billings' ability to terrorize Brian Teflon. George Bond obviously was able to follow Matt Brandau all over. There's no question that Matt Brandau is not the most athletic guy, but is he within spitting distance of being as athletic as Keegan Khan? I think so. So point being that, like, I don't know. That's just that's the approach that I hope Princeton employs. You're going to give up some easy goals. You just have to accept that and hope two things happen as a result. The first is you essentially trick them into taking shots that aren't good shots so that you can get your goalie hot. And then you wear them out and they stop being as efficient late in game. And whether that gives you an opportunity to come back or gives you an opportunity to steal one if it's a close game late. Like, that to me is the strategy that we haven't seen really employed against this Maryland team. And not to say that it's going to work, but because we haven't seen it employed, I guess we don't know that it doesn't work. So that was the one thing I wanted to see Virginia do, and they didn't. Next game?
Yes.
All right, let's quickly just finish up talking about Princeton's 14-10 victory over Yale. You know, this was a similar game in the sense that Princeton really thrived by virtue of the variety of their offensive production. And, you know, you can look at it both ways. A 14-10 game, was it Yale's defense not holding Princeton to fewer than 14? Was it Yale's offense not scoring more than 10 that more greatly contributed to the result? So I think as a result, it was kind of 50-50, particularly because you would have expected potentially Tyler Sandoval to have a dominant game at the faceoff X given what he did to BU, when in fact Nicholas Ramsey won more than 50%, or Yale as a team did, and it was led by Ramsey. So, you know, for me, I think that it was Yale's offense and their inability to get to the 15, 16, 17 goals that you would have expected. Jared Paquette was the reason that Princeton's offense didn't get to 20, because he made 16 saves in the first half and it was incredible. They only got to 8 goals. But at the same time, to the extent that credit starts with the Princeton offense, they didn't have a guy that scored more than 3 points. Sammy English had 3 goals. Chris Brown had a goal and 2 assists. Coulter Maxey had 2 goals and an assist. Everybody else had 2 or fewer points. And they just got really good contributions from all over the place. In addition to at the other end of the field, as I mentioned, George Bond holding Matt Brandau to a goal and an assist. And otherwise, just kind of forcing the Bulldogs or allowing the Bulldogs to make a lot of uncharacteristic turnovers. It was, you know, another pretty impressive showing from Princeton, but in the same way that I felt after the BU game that their best game is still out there, I think that's still true for Matt Madelon's team.
I did too. I think the story really was, like, you know, you're talking about, was it Yale D or Yale O? And I think it was a lot of between the lines. Like, the amount of failed clears, or like, and I'll even throw like the first 10 seconds of an offensive possession in with that quote unquote clear, because I couldn't believe that a team that's on the verge of getting sent home for the season let their stick skills get the best of them. And, you know, maybe to your point, whether it's, I don't think a team as experienced or as good as Yale could attribute it up to nerves. You know, I just thought it was very weird to see them consistently skyrocket. And I was watching this game with a first-time lacrosse fan. It was me, one of my buddies that played at Delaware, and then his friend who had never really watched a lacrosse game. And he just kept asking, he's like, so is the ball supposed to go over people's head like this often? Or is this just weird? And I had to keep explaining to him. I'm like, you know, it's just really weird to see a team this good consistently turn the ball over. And I think that when you have that, there's absolutely no chance to win. That sucks the wind out of your offense and your defense. Like, the defense can't even rally and get excited and, like, let's make a big stop for them to, you know, go score. The offense, you know, there were a couple times where in the third and fourth quarter you saw a turnover and you just saw the body language of Yale just be deflated. Like, oh, you got to be kidding me. So I think, like, silly mistakes were really the story for Yale, in my opinion. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that George Bahan is my absolute king of kings, and that slide was my favorite play of the lacrosse season so far.
All right, let's come back to that. I just want to add to your point about the first 10 seconds of an offensive possession. It's also the last 10 seconds after a faceoff win. Nick Ramsey had 4 turnovers, right? So when you win 15 yes. faceoffs and then you have 4 turnovers, like, you might as well have won 11 faceoffs, right? So, and maybe it's even more damaging than just losing a faceoff, because, as you said, like, kind of takes the wind out of your sails, right? Whereas maybe a normal faceoff loss doesn't have that same type of effect.
100%. Like, having been there as a player, like, you know, the faceoff and then skyball, it's just like the whole team is just like, oh, dude, like, defense needed a break. Offense needs to get into a rhythm. And it just felt like they never could really get into a rhythm.
George Bahan, high and late. You loved it. King. Didn't get a flag.
Did not get a flag, which I love. I mean, you know, I feel like there's, you know, that huge shift to be, you know, protecting the players and everything like that. But I still think there is room for huge physical hits like this. Textbook shoulder to the chest, great follow through, helmet pops off. Like, and I don't know, it was one of the best tweets, you know, from a numbers standpoint, which shows me that there is a complete appetite. People that I was, you know, on the football team with were reaching out like, damn, I didn't know people could hit like that. First off, humble brag on my part right there. I think Courier from, it was Courier or another Princeton guy was like, oh yeah, cause I'm going to send him a shirt. Cause I just, that's what I'm going to do to thank him for his service. And
him being George,
he was like,
or
oh,
whoever
yeah,
else from Princeton reached out to you.
No, George.
Okay.
I tweeted out, I was like, someone give me this kid's information. I want to send him a shirt. And Courier texted it to me and was like, oh, and this kid is like one of the biggest freaks I've ever seen in my life. Of course, in a good way. So I like him. He might be my second favorite player behind someone who we'll talk about in Cornell.
Got it. Well, let's save that one for last because I have a really nice segue with helmets not staying on because Jared Jen Felix's helmet came off like four times in the Rutgers 11-9 win over Penn. And in one instance, it directly led to a goal because he lost his helmet and then immediately he reached down, put it back on and stepped in front of his goalie as a shot was being taken that went in. So fortunately for him and the Scarlet Knights, it did not cost them the game, but it happened in a moment when I had just said to all the Inside Lacrosse staff, I was like, this is the type of moment where Penn's offense is so stagnant that they're going to need a couple of weird goals in order to get back into this game. And that absolutely qualified as one. And what was crazy is that, you know, we had seen these types of games. I think that the Delaware-Cornell game was similar. I think the Georgetown-Delaware game was similar. I think maybe even the Richmond Penn game was similar in the sense that, you know, kind of nip and tuck through the first 30 or 40 minutes, and then one team pulls away, gets a 2-3, maybe even a 4-goal lead, and then the other team comes back and either ties it or, you know, gets it within that type of vibe range where it's like either team can win this game. And that was kind of the thing that happened. And then Rutgers was able to pull away down the stretch, you know, again, a game where there wasn't one dominant offensive performance, which, you know, I think if we were looking at this in terms of like four game sets, we really, you know, kind of would, with the exception of Ty Kurtz scoring 5 goals for Delaware, really say that, and maybe in this instance, you kind of would even, this would qualify because it's like, defenses did a really nice job taking opposing number one threats out of the game. Sam Hanley had 0 goals and 3 assists. CJ Kirst had 1 goal. And Matt Brando had 1 goal and 1 assist. Connor Schellenberger was 0-0. Even Logan Wisnoskis was 3-2, which is below his season scoring average. So that and impressive goalie play all around, to me, those were the unifying factors between this game. What did you take away from Rutgers' win over Penn?
I mean, I think it was a tale of two offenses, and I called out last episode, I believe, that if Penn were to play a team like Cornell, who has a shutdown defender, I think that their offense is prone to being stagnant, and I think that's exactly what we saw. You know, I think Hanley had no goals in the game, if I recall.
That's correct.
And I think that if you hold them to zero, I don't think they have a balanced enough attack to really, you know, create productive shots. And then conversely with Rutgers, it wasn't the fact, you know, almost in contrast to what I was saying about Maryland, there are some shots they take that, you know, I'm like, well, how could that even be considered a good shot? But then, you know, like it'll be that lefty running down the alley, stinging a low to high from 5 yards above the cage. And I was like, that was a terrible take, but he placed it unbelievably well. So I kind of like, you know, it was interesting in that point where it was like a stagnant Penn offense that couldn't really get decent shots versus Rutgers who, you know, decided not to get decent shots in lieu of any opportunity that they wanted. But I just think that like it's a bit of a shame that Penn couldn't figure out a way for the offense to click a little bit more, because I think they had the pieces. I just don't think they had either, you know, call it the chemistry, call it the depth of playbook, call it whatever, so that when they go stagnant, they can do something to generate a little bit of buzz. And I think that's was something that, you know, might have been called out earlier. And I think that it's not that surprising that that ended up being the nail in the coffin on this season.
Yeah. And I think that anybody who was kind of forecasting that, to your point, kind of wasn't surprised with the way that it manifested, but it also was one of those things where it was like, you know, we had a 90-degree day on Saturday in Long Island and a 70-degree day in Columbus on Sunday. Was it luck of the draw? And if some of these teams that had depth issues or, you know, had an over-reliance on one or two players issues, which is a little different from not having depth, would they have been better off? And it's, you know, a counterfactual that ultimately probably doesn't give any consolation to the teams that lost. But if you're a fan thinking about it, it's food for thought.
Yeah.
Hard to play in 90 degrees,
I got
right?
Nothing else on that. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. My fat ass. You kidding me?
Fat Nick Acello chiming in. Cornell 10, Delaware 8. This was the first game on Sunday in Columbus. As mentioned, CJ Kearse, who came in as the Big Red second leading scorer, limited to one goal as he was guarded by Owen Grant, who had an awesome goal in transition off of the faceoff. It was very similar to the Pat Clemens from St. Joe's play that we talked about on the podcast last week in the Hawks lost to Yale. This was a game in which Cornell got out to a 2-0 lead. Delaware came back and led 4-2. Cornell responded and built a lead through the middle of the third quarter. And then Delaware scored three straight to tie it at 7 heading into the fourth. Big Red pulled away with three straight goals, and Delaware wasn't able to close the gap down the stretch. During that three-goal run at the end of the third quarter for Delaware, Ty Kearse scored three of his five goals, and all three of them came off of he was standing there. The guy covering him slid adjacent. The guy with the ball threw in the ball, and he stepped down. One came from the righty wing, and two came from the lefty wing, and it was a really good method that had worked for Delaware throughout the season. Unfortunately, Drew Lankitis, who had shown himself to be their fire starter against Georgetown, didn't have that same type of magic. And I think part of that goes credit-wise to Harrison Bardwell and Christopher Davis, who I thought did a really nice job on Sunday afternoon. And then at the other end of the field, you know, Michael Long, John Piatelli, they got two goals from Spencer Wertheim, which is a second-line middie. You know, basically Cornell did just enough in order to survive this game. And I think that, you know, I would say something similar to what I said about Princeton, which is that they still haven't played their best game. And it's potential that they're going to play it on the semifinals, and it's going to send them to the Final Four or send them to the championship game. We'll see. Cornell's got the Rutgers Scarlet Knights in the first game on Saturday in the NCAA semifinals.
It's really interesting watching this Delaware offense, because, you know, they have shades of brilliance, and then they have shades of what was that? And I think that they did a bad job of taking shots that let Chase Ireland, who does not have any siblings that have achieved any level of success to my knowledge, get comfortable in cage. You know, it's like either they were moving great off ball, they would slide, and then there would be an easy step down for a layup, or they would take a shot off of their back foot with defensive pressure that was going 60 miles an hour right into the breadbasket. So I think that like consistency kind of bit Delaware in the ass, because when they were on, I was like, Delaware is going to win this. Like, Delaware is going to beat Cornell. This is incredible. And then credit to Cornell. I think they did a better job of kind of learning how this Delaware defense worked over the course of the game. You know, there was a lull in the set. They went scoreless for a significant amount of time, and I think it was because they weren't realizing how aggressive Delaware was sliding. And I think Delaware's defense did a good job of being aggressive, you know, getting in the lane of shots, and then, you know, there were some good saves. But, you know, I think what Cornell did a good job of was recognizing what wasn't working. You know, I'll give a good amount of credit to Buzek for kind of saying, okay, guys, you know, we're in a close one here. We kind of know we're the better team that can be more consistent. And I think in the end, it was the consistency of Cornell not taking horrible shots like Delaware did, and not giving up absolute layups for, you know, after that three goal run that ended up being, you know, the final.
Nick, this was a short one. We only had four games to talk about. And next week, we only have three games to talk about. This is the last one.
Yeah, well, and I'll say, if it's a more entertaining game, I can riff for hours, but I feel like every single game, 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter, it was the writing was on the wall and it was a snooze fest. So, if you want more entertaining podcasts, how about you tell these teams to play more entertaining games?
It's a great note to end on. We appreciate you guys checking this one out, and we'll be back next week with the final tailgate of the 2022 season.
Love you,
Love
Terry.
you, Nick. Hey, I'm Terry Foley.
And I'm Nick Ocello. Welcome to the tailgate.